Radio EcoShock.
While hospitals and schools struggle, humans spend more on the military every year. In 2022, world military spending hit another record high of around $2.2 trillion. But what will all those uniforms and equipment do as the climate changes and new pressures come into society? Will they protect fossil fuel investments? Dr. Elizabeth Bolton was a logistics officer for the Australian Army, including a tour in Iraq. Now she is a climate security researcher. Elizabeth has worked with the Australian Bureau of Meteorology and the National Climate Center. In 2022, the U.S. Marine Corps Press published Bolton's paper called, get ready for this, Plan E, A Grand Strategy for the 21st Century Era of Entangled Security and Hyperthreats. It is a ground-up rethink of who we are and how humans operate against threats like climate change. From Australia, Elizabeth Bolton, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Before we dive right into the deep end, if you were at a party or just a casual experience, how would you introduce your work?
I'm a security theorist who centres the climate and ecological crisis as the primary threat, and then considers how we might apply some military thinking to contain that threat.
Now, most of what we think and do follows established patterns. We have, like, habits running almost on autopilot. Is that getting closer to this fundamental concept that some call the deep frame?
Yes, actually, deep framing, I got that term from George Lakoff, who you probably know, a pretty famous cognitive scientist and linguist. And deep frames refers to these neuron pathways that we develop from birth through our life, through interaction with the external world. And they form our philosophy and our way of seeing the world, as opposed to just immediate knowledge that we might learn in a trade course or a degree or something like that. But it's our fundamental philosophical outlook. And what they find is that influences people's decision-making at a subconscious level, up to 80 to 90% of the time. But we're generally unconscious of it because it's sort of the conceptual space we're swimming in, like a fish swimming in the water. So a whole lot of cognitive research suggested that one of the reasons we're having difficulty coming to terms with the climate and ecological emergency is that we haven't really grasped it at a deep frame level, because it doesn't interact in the normal sort of way that our senses can interpret it.
You based some of your work, or at least you were helped along the way by ecological philosopher Timothy Morton, and the Wikipedia entry for Tim Morton has this insight. It says, quote, global warming is made apparent through emissions levels, temperature changes, and ocean levels, making it seem as if global warming is a product of scientific models rather than an object that predates its own measurement. Is that capturing some of what you just said?
Yeah, his concept is completely fundamental to my concept of hyperthreat. I just modify it a little bit. He's contesting the idea that we can project, manage, and even understand this phenomena that's occurring, that the way that the climate system interconnects with water cycles, nitrogen cycles, ecological breakdown and so forth. But it's got its own agency, and we can understand glimpses of it through science and personal observation and stories, but we're only ever, and one of his key things that he's saying is that we have to get out of this idea that we can project manage this, that this, the hyper object of global warming will be the major actor of this century, and humans will move to a reactive stance and we'll be on the back foot, and in fact we'll be as insignificant as leaves being blown by the wind on the sidewalk. He has been criticised at some stages for having a bit of a too dark a vision, where the humans are completely powerless. My concept, which may be naive, suggests humans have got a little tiny bit of agency. But yeah, basically he's really trying to tackle the arrogance of the way we see the world at the moment, that we think we can just sort of project manage this problem on the side and get on with life as normal.
If we ran into some alien from outer space and we had no idea really what they were, we're sort of in the same situation with climate change, Morton suggests, and he calls climate change a hyper object. Would you like to take a couple of minutes and just tell us some of the aspects of what a hyperobject might be?
Yeah, so he has some fairly complicated terms for it. Its simple definition is that it's a thing that is spread across enormous space and time relative to humans. And, you know, it operates across scales of hundreds of thousands of years and so forth. And in that, he's talking about effect of microplastics or, you know, I think there's some plastics that take 500,000 years to break down and things like that. So he's those type of time frames are completely beyond the human sort of understanding of time, which is generally a few generations. But he describes it as having five very specific characteristics. The five characteristics is one is that it's interobjective, which means that we never can see it in its own right, that it operates through other objects. So, for example, the way that the wind blows, you don't actually see the wind. You hear it and you see the leaves moving or the curtains moving, but you don't see wind itself. So, and the same with the drought. You might see the cracked soil, and that may be a sign of global warming or it may just be a normal type of drought. So that's something that you can't see. The other one is this idea of viscosity, which is that it's infused through everything. And one of the examples is that, for example, if you consider the oxygen in your nose right at the moment, that it's a higher part per million of carbon than it was in the pre-industrial era. Anyway, you go through all of these characteristics, but basically what they are designed to do is convey the idea that this is something we can't tangibly see and measure, and it is beyond us, and beyond all of our normal little systems of how we manage problems with taxes and things like that. But one of the key things he says is that it existentially demotes the human being from being that masters of the planet to suddenly we're just another object with a whole stack of other objects of microbacteria and whales and all sorts of forms of life, and we're just another one of those that will be affected by this dominant hyperobject, which is now the most powerful force, and it will shape the next century.
Wow. Okay. Now you're offering a new twist or a new idea called the hyper threat. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah. So his concept is just global warming. So I bring all arrays of climate degradation and destruction into it, which includes sort of toxins in food and chemicals and microplastics, salinity and so on. And I'm basically saying if you put them together, the whole thing constitute, because they're so interconnected, that they constitute a new thing called a hyper threat. And the use of the word threat is very deliberate because while Morton's concept of a hyperobject is just sort of this sort of neutral big thing, like a strange sort of monster we've never really encountered before, but it's sort of off in the ether, in the universe sort of thing. But the word threat is, and this is different from the climate crisis or climate emergency framings, which emphasise urgency. But threat has a greater allusion to violence and killing and destruction and harm, and not where the word risk, for example, means that it might happen, but threat means it's likely, you know, it's on the way. It will happen. It's already been, you know, acknowledged that it exists. And with that, I'm also proposing that it's not just a policy problem, and there is a new form of conscious intent to cause harm, because when you interrogate the hyper threat and what's enabling it and what's causing it, it does appear that there are human actors with a consciousness of what they're doing and going ahead anyway. And this is a fairly important delineation as well, because previously in security circles, natural events like, you know, a devastating cyclone or a terrible drought, these were classified as hazards, which mean terrible things that happen, but there's no conscious human hostile intent. Someone's not choosing to harm other people. So they were in the hazard category, and that means that they don't go into a national security threat analysis as you know, very significant. But if we acknowledge that there are new forms, and like the hyper threat, they're sort of diffused through all our legal systems and economic systems, but nonetheless there are new forms of conscious decisions to cause harm. You know, I think it's pretty clear with what's happened with the fossil fuel industry and the cover-ups and misinformation and the intention to keep exploiting beyond safe limits, but this is there's a consciousness of decision making there. And the reason that's important to identify is because once we realise that we're actually talking about conscious intent to cause harm and killing, then that provides a much stronger argument for all range of legal mechanisms to rein in the hyper threat actors, which at the moment I assess this is a threat that's essentially off the leash, and its main source of power is its freedom of action. And it's considered legal, it's considered legitimate, and it's, you know, untold amount of killing, but considered, oh well, that's just economic progress. That's sort of the difference between the hyper threat concept and other framings like crisis, emergency. And even if I can just add, with the polycrisis frame that's going around at the moment, really being promoted by the WEF, that's sort of this idea that there's multiple concurrent crises. But I was just reading up on it this morning, and on their website they've got all these comments saying things, for example, like, oh, we can't reverse the polycrisis, and that we suggest people get therapy to help cope with the psychological effects, and, you know, the next decade is going to involve polycrisis in multiple crises. But it's quite a clever framing because it takes away any accountability, and it creates a sort of helplessness as though nobody's actually causing it, and the only thing the individual can do is, you know, go and see a therapist. It's very clever how that some of these framings take away accountability for who is causing the problem.
Yes, this is not just a philosophical debate. I mean, you also helped international aid groups overseas. You trained in the Australian Army with a specialty in strategic planning, and you published your paper last year by the U.S. Marine Corps University Press. What is happening with your fundamental rethink towards climate-friendly military planning? Is that an oxymoron?
Well, it's even though it was the Marines who published it, it's probably worth me emphasising that it's actually, as you alluded to at the start, it's a fundamental rethink of how we approach security. So Plan E, in fact, argues for a civilian mobilisation as opposed to militarisation. And because that's right to the exact nature of the threat and the types of skill sets and so forth that are needed to respond to it. So even though it is in a military journal, I am actually arguing for a civilian mobilisation. And the other thing is part of it is that it's a very much a bottom-up design strategy. It's creating a framework for all the sector experts and experts across all sorts of areas. It's like they're given a mission and they're given support to create their solutions. And in fact, a year is dedicated to deliberate planning across all the sectors and all the areas of the economy and community to start designing their response to the hyper response. So that would involve skilling up the civilian population with some of these threat planning tools. And so some of the methods that militaries have used would be adjusted so that they could be used and contribute in the civilian context. In some ways, it's very different from what I noticed, again, what's going on with some of these IPCC and so forth, is very much a top-down, that the solutions are being sort of presented to the people, and the people themselves aren't having, you know, it's quite a battle to get ideas and concepts heard. But this is a fundamental, the responsibility for security actually returns to local levels and populations, because in fact that's where the hyper threat is increasingly going to strike. And that is also where all the solutions and the human ingenuity lies. It's sort of like a World War II mobilisation, where we have to have the whole of society participation. But I've been quite careful to say that the model I've developed is not a military-led initiative, it's a civilian-led initiative. And that the military are in support of... So, for example, the civilian world will launch this huge hyper-response force, and that group will need security and support from its military, but the military isn't driving the event or the response.
Right. I'm kind of conflicted about all this because in some ways the military may become dangerous for the future, especially if they arrest the people who are protesting fossil fuels and things like that. But on the other hand, as you say, profits from environmental crime may rise as resources become more rare or restricted. We're facing some instability, some fragility. I'll bet we'll expect that we need police and a repurposed military, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I argue in the paper, and and there's another paper coming out in a few months, actually, with the Oxford University book that looks at these things, that our security posture at the moment is completely incoherent because it is being used in such a way that it makes the hyper threat stronger. And also, you know, just to give one very tangible example, that we now understand that the Iraq war was about oil. So essentially, we sent $2 million, killed, you know, roughly around 500,000 people to get oil, which makes, and cementing oil dependency, which makes the hyper threat stronger, you know, exasperates global warming, plus all the, you know, the damage to the environment and so forth and the emissions of that activity. But, and so militaries often get used in this indirect way to support resource extraction industry. It's called systems maintenance, as a term made by Doug Stokes. And it was initially sort of this idea, well, it's the right thing of the military to keep supply chains functioning because that helps the civilian population. But what it means is if that military support is supporting a fossil fuel intensive supply chain, our militaries are now working for our enemy. So now the idea with Plan E is that all of that security apparatus now moves to the hyper response force. And so say, for example, there is, and you know, a lot of the areas of the world are in conflict at the moment. Say, for example, there's somewhere in Sudan where somebody's trying to set up an amazing solar panel array, and that in fact, there's some conflict nearby. The security task would be to protect that solar installation. But more importantly, protect places like the Amazon and critical marine areas and from overfishing and those sort of things. And when it comes to that disaster response, I'm not sure what it's like in America and other countries, but in Australia, we have been using our defence force as that first call for major disasters to help in the clean-up and so forth. But in the most recent Defence Strategic Review, now the defence has said, look, we don't want to do that because it detracts us from our war posture and we're trying to prepare for a possible World War III and we don't have space or time to do another task. And we think it should be a civilian task to, you know, increase civilian capability in that area, firefighting and so on. The way things are at the moment, they're saying they don't want to do it. The security narrative on the side at the moment, the dominant narrative is preparations for a World War III with having militarisation all over the world. And in fact, if you look at this, what is really happening, I think, is preparations for a fight for what's left. And these are forms of resource wars. And so we're really at this point in time where we decide how are we going to use our security forces and our security strategy. Is it just going to be a fight to the death over what as everything starts unravelling? Or are we going to fundamentally change things and say let's protect the foundation of security, which is a viable ecological habitat? So my concept is that we have a planetary emergency peace treaty, which is in everybody's interest, and that all that energy, all that money, all that engineering and technical expertise is channeled to one mission, which is let's reduce emissions as much as we possibly can. We obviously can't stop global warming at this stage, but we can reduce the severity.
Let it be so. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Elizabeth Bolton, military analyst and climate researcher. We're trying to understand what climate change is and why we're not really trying to solve it yet. So along those lines, you talk about something called entanglement, and it seems very fundamental. Would you tell us what you mean by that?
So I've got this term called entangled security, and that at its most basic level, it means that planetary, human, and state security are inherently entangled. So it's the idea that military activity can't really just be quarantined off as something that's over there and it doesn't affect the rest of society. And a very tangible activity example of that is just last week, a whole lot of leaders from Africa went and had a round table in Ukraine and Russia, and they said to Putin, look, this war is really hurting us because of the grain and food security impacts. Increasingly, it's an idea that everybody else's insecurity affects everybody else. So the weaker and harsher that we hurt other people, that affects us because inherently our existence is that we are all entangled with each other. So it's sort of the idea that if you hurt and damage another part of the entangled web of which we're all part of, it's sort of like shooting yourself in the foot. Another sort of example of way of seeing that is that through sort of multinationals really having some very exploitive practices all through the developing world and leaving those countries in poverty and taking the resources at ridiculous prices and destabilising a lot of those countries, often for the very purpose of getting resources. But the backfire of that is that all those unemployed people who haven't been able to participate normally in the economy in the world have then become a workforce for these burgeoning transnational crime groups who are now the employers of choice. And, you know, the new sort of money is human trafficking, organ trafficking, drugs, and illegal wildlife trade, illegal logging, illegal fishing, and that those activities are ones that harm everybody as the drugs infiltrate through the society and so on. So, and there's this old concept of security that you gain security through being more powerful and stronger than the other. But I'm actually arguing that in this new era that we gain security by making the other stronger and more secure. There's two ends of the spectrum, is that the old way was to take from the other and make them as weak as possible. And the new way is to care and strengthen for the other, to give strength and so forth. For this Plan E, for example, one of the things is to weaponise employment and to creating this massive hyper-response force and giving people reasonably paid jobs and a dignified living, that we become the job providers of choice, and we extract those people away from some of that real destructive transnational crime activity, and they come and work for the hyper-response force. So, yeah, entanglement, I might just stop there, but it has actually got a whole stack of philosophical dimensions related to quantum physics and so forth, but I can expand on those a bit more if you like, but I might just pause there for a second.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I can see what you're talking about. I mean, we are all interrelated, and I see it, for example, in recent news in the tensions between China and the United States as though a war might be the outcome of that. That would be terrible. I mean, everything that we buy here in North America is made in China, and the Chinese economy depends entirely on sales to North America. So it's like one hand attacking the other hand. It's just not going to work out. I also wonder, though, too, we react heavily to the pandemic, and if we change a lot of things because of the pandemic or because of our fight on climate change, can our reactions also become part of the hyper threat as well if we're not careful?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we're in such, so I read somewhere the other day, they say that, you know, you purchase an electronic vehicle, but then that has ramifications for where you're getting the rare earth metals. So there's a lot of these bind situations where you're trying to do something, it still creates some harm, but maybe it's marginally better than another type of harm. What that says to me is that an incredible amount of care is required in how we plan our response. And I'm a big fan of deliberate planning for crisis. And what worries me the most is that there is no deliberate, I don't think there's a deliberate plan at the moment for a crisis situation. Although a lot of people have declared climate emergencies and, you know, there's some innovations, we're not really on a crisis or emergency footing. And we're not doing any planning for an emergency or crisis footing. So because, we did do a war game of this earlier in the year, and what that proved to me was that, and even myself looking at Plan E, is that when you start to think, okay, finally let's imagine that we all decide that we're going to really go for it, that when we decide we're going to go for it, that itself is an incredibly complex, difficult problem, and we should, you know, we really need to be doing a lot of careful planning and the feedback loops of what works and information sharing and being setting ourselves up for that learning experience, because it's very, very difficult and it's going to require all sorts of expertise, you know, so we don't make fatal mistakes.
So you call for a complete rearrangement of human operating systems, I think, not just a change in business, but society itself. And you also say to avoid the disaster of hothouse Earth, and this is backed up by the scientists that I interview here on Radio EcoShock, this all has to happen in the next few years, maybe the next 7 or 10 years at the most. Are you a revolutionary?
You could use that word, I guess, but I see myself, I came back from Iraq, I saw the whole thing with weapons and mass destruction was, you know, a lie. I really do have a security ethic in terms of wanting to protect the people and the world, the beautiful world that we have. And so I actually just see myself as a bona fide security thinker that wants to protect the population. And when I see a sign from the scientist that says we've got X amount of years, my brain just goes into logistic planning mode and how do we practically enact an emergency. I'll just highlight, when you're talking about those timeframes, Plan E is just a planning year. There is some emergency actions, but it's predominantly deliberate planning across society for a year. Then we go into what's called Plan F, which is 4 years fast and furious. So it's 4 years, everyone across the world, just giving it everything we've got to clean up this planet. It's like a tip at the moment in a lot of areas. And that becomes a security mission. And when you think about it, 4 years, you know, it's not that long in terms of compared to World War One or World War Two, but, you know, that's to save our future. And that involves the redirection of, for example, the military-industrial complex, all those great huge companies like Lockheed Martin and so forth that have a lot of expertise, that expertise is channeled at the problem. And the finance sector there, it becomes a mission for them to implement degrowth. And one of the ideas is like a wartime situation, you might just have, they might say, look, let's just give everyone a universal basic income for 4 years while we clean up this planet as much as we possibly are. And that allows 4 years for the economic and finance people to come up with a more durable, long-term solution with consultation with people and so forth. But in the short term, we just need something that people can get along with and focus on actually doing an emergency response.
What sort of reaction are you getting? Are you being heard?
No, yeah, that's this is very interesting. Is that as soon as it was published by the Marines, there's all these climate security think tanks around the world, and they, except for the one at Oxford University, they have all basically completely blocked it. The public are interested, and I did a talk yesterday, and I've been doing various community talks and webinars and podcasts, and I find the community quite receptive to the idea, but I am finding that the officials in climate policy and security policy are not. But having said that large generalisation, I'm also finding that across various sectors, and there are odd individuals who might be in the military or they might be, you know, in the trades area or anything, there are odd individuals who create opportunities for new ideas to be heard. And I think what I'm assessing is that we have this very controlled narrative environment that actually it's just becoming down to individuals of good conscience who create space for new ideas. And you couldn't really say it's this sector or that sector that's helping. But quite amazingly, I think, you know, one of my supervisors on my panel is one of the vice chairs of the IPCC, and he has absolutely turned his back on it. And a number of pretty senior people in climate policy, yeah, that's been a little bit hard to understand.
I think you're a little ahead of your time, and that's not good because we don't have very much time. So that's why I'm really pleased to have you on Radio EcoShock and to have our listeners tune into this. And you've been hearing from Dr. Elizabeth Bolton. You can find links to her work and a few helpful notes about this interview in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Liz, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for stretching our minds.
Thanks so much for giving space.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.